Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fucking ears? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. WTF. My podcast. Thank you for coming. If you're new here, welcome. If you're been here before, welcome back. If you're leaving right now, see you later, fucker. It's all right. It's okay. I get it. Maybe fast forwarding up to the interview. Whatever you want to do. It's really okay with me. As I detach more and more from what I think your expectations to be, I find freedom in that. But nonetheless, today on the show, I have the Mike Binder, the comedian, filmmaker, actor, and now author of a, he's written a new thriller. You know, I'll tell you about Binder. He just wrote a book. He wrote a thriller called Keep Calm. It's available everywhere tomorrow. February 2nd, a thriller. But this guy was a comic, and he's one of the reasons why I actually, not that I started doing comedy, but I love comedy. If that makes, I'll try to explain that in a minute. Let me see if I can get some other business out of the way. Well, as some of you know, Louis C.K. did an amazing thing. He did something that, there's a few amazing things about what he's done with his new piece of work, Horace and Pete's. This is a downloadable piece of, what would you even call it? It's definitely not a television show because he has brought new definition to what is possible through self-producing and through internet distribution. Well, here's what happened. A couple weeks ago, Louis was in town. He was here to for the Television Critics Association thing out in Pasadena. He was here with Zach, and he came over, and we didn't get on the mics. We just went out, and we had something to eat, and we sat in here and talked for about 2 hours about this thing he was doing that I had to be sworn to secrecy about. You can go to louisck.net and download Horace and Pete. And it all takes place on one or two sets. It's in a bar. But here's the beautiful thing about it. Everybody was running around going, what's Louis going to do now that he's not doing the show? What's he going to do? Well, he sort of compulsively created this very dark but beautiful series that when you watch it, reads like a stage play. It stars Alan Alda, Steve Buscemi, Edie Falco, Jessica Lange, Stephen Wright. Kurt Metzger is fucking genius in it. Fucking Kurt, Nick DiPaolo's there. But he told me about this whole thing where he just self-financed this this project. You know, he got all these amazing talents to work for whatever they're working for. He reached out to a bunch of people. He found out Paul Simon was a fan of his, and he met with Paul Simon, and Paul Simon agreed to do the song for it. It was so beautiful. He's sitting here, he's like playing me the theme song of Horace and Pete. He's like, who is that? And I'm like, oh, fuck, I know that voice. And it's like, fucking Paul Simon, it's Paul Simon. But anyways, we talked for like an hour, over an hour about this thing, about how it all came together. Off mic. And then the fucker, we get up, he's like, oh, we really should have recorded that. Yes, we should have. Because the story of how Louis self-produced and kept secret an incredibly dark, sort of undefinable project. I mean, it's almost like an O'Neill play. It's like theater. It's shot on a soundstage, and there's no audience, and it's full of dramatic pauses. It's not, you know, necessarily funny all the time. Alan Alda is doing something that I've never seen him do, and it's all written by Lou. And it's just Louis executing the Louis vision in a completely unfiltered way, but in a completely structured way like I've never seen him do before. And, you know, it's weird what when you have a friend, and we are friends, who, you know, is possessed by a certain genius and gets things done. So that's the difference between people who accomplish things and people who get upset about people who accomplish things or who chip away at people who accomplish things. That's what they put their energy into, is people who accomplish things. They set their mind to something and they do it. They harness their creativity. They harness their passion. They harness their instincts, and they understand their limitations and work within them to create things. And then there are people There are people out there that don't do that, but still demand attention, demand to have a voice. What was amazing to me was that Louis just completely just fuck Twitter. Fuck it. Got off because, you know, he understood the vortex of it. He understood his own compulsion around it, as I do, but I can't get out of it just yet because, you know, I'll kick tomorrow. But it takes, you know, you really have to make a choice not to be a maggot among maggots, you know, ferociously feeding on the corpse of culture. Just fucking monsters out there. It's just like, I guess my point is, Louis's a fucking doer, and he's inspired, and he's a fucking genius, and it's always amazing to see a genius do what they do on their own terms. And I think if you go watch this Horace and Pete thing, you'll be like, what the fuck is it? Doesn't matter. It's beautiful on a lot of levels. It's something completely unto itself, and it's released completely in its own world. It's something that he is solely responsible for, and nobody else got involved with it. And it involves an amazing ensemble of talent and an amazing ensemble of what seems to be lighting and camera operators and art deck. But it's like nothing you've ever seen before, and it's just Louis once again kind of breaking the mold, shifting the paradigm, showing people what they can do if they just let their creativity fucking just let it roll. So this is not a paid plug. This is a friend plug, because I got so fucking excited when I was talking to him. Like, I was beside myself that he had done this amazing thing. And then I couldn't say anything about it, which isn't that big a problem. I don't talk to many people, but I couldn't wait for it to be released. Because how often does somebody do something that nobody knows anything about with that amount of talent and that amount of production? It was just fucking spectacular. Anyways, I loved it. It's powerful. It's dark. It's moving. It's multi-leveled. It's theater. It's fucking theater. Louis C.K. now can add playwright, as far as I'm concerned, to his long resume. So check that out. Again, not a sponsored plug. Friend plug. I wish we would have fucking recorded the stories he told me in making that thing. But anyways, check that out. Horace and Pete. Go to louisck.net. Mike Binder. Mike Binder's coming. I can't, like, this is one of those people that, you know, many of you might not know. But I was fucking dying to talk to him. When I was a kid and I watched the stand-up shows, Mike Binder was this young guy, almost looked like a kid. He had his hair combed over, his blonde hair. He looked like he was like 20. And he was hilarious. He was a hilarious comic. I still remember the bits. You know, A Day at Disneyland. And also, like, I remember one thing I saw him do. He grabbed a camera from someone in the audience, took a picture of his crotch, and he said, explain that to the guy at the drugstore. And he made me want to do comedy. Mike Binder. And then when I got to the Comedy Store, he was this mythic guy there. Like, he hadn't been there in years, but he was like the golden boy. He was like he was Mitzi Shore's pick to be the next big comedy star. He was at the Comedy Store when he was 20. I don't know how old he was, maybe in his teens, 22, way back when the original crew was there. He got all fucked up on drugs and pulled out. But, you know, he went on to make pretty amazing movies. Coupe de Ville, Crossing the Bridge, Indian Summer, Blank Man. The Mind of the Married Man on HBO was his creation. The Upside of Anger was his movie. Reign Over Me was his movie. But he was one of those guys that during the beginning of the independent movie thing, he was a guy writing and making his own movies. And now he's writing thrillers. But to me, he was this young guy who did these, who was hilarious. So to get the whole story from Mike was really a treat for me. So let's go now to my conversation with Mike Binder.
Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Binder. I've wanted to have you on for a long time because I think you were one of the first guys I saw do stand-up on television.
Oh, really?
Is that possible?
Probably, yeah. I mean, I started really young. I was on television when I was 18 years old.
Really? So what year would that have been?
Jesus.
Like 74?
77.
77?
Yeah. Probably.
So I would have been like 14?
Yeah, so I was 18.
You're only a few years older than me.
Yeah, but I was 18 when I was on The Tonight Show and Merv Griffin.
Right. And I feel like it was Merv Griffin.
Yeah, I was on that. I was on that about 7 or 8 times, you know?
A day in Disneyland.
That's right, yeah. That's right.
And I know that when I talked to you on the phone, that you were nervous that I would get hung up on the stand-up because it's so long ago.
Well, no, it's not that. It's just that, you know, the people that are into the Comedy Store and the Comedy Store scene are so into it. And it's like, for me, it's such a small part of my life.
Right.
Because you got to remember, I got there when I was 18 and I was gone when I was 26, you know?
Right.
So it was like,
out of stand-up.
Yeah. So it was like, it was an extended college for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, I wasn't completely out of. I was out of the Comedy Store when I was about 26, and I was out of stand up probably when I was about 28 or 29. You know, it became one of those things where, you know, how many things can you do? You know?
Right, but let me just track it. So, where'd you grow up?
Detroit.
In the city.
In the city of Detroit, 7 Mile in Libernoy, yeah.
And what was that?
I lived a block from Baker's Keyboard Lounge, which was the world's oldest jazz club. But when I was a kid, I would drive my bike through the alley. And then one day I remember seeing the marquee said, Comic Lenny Bruce.
Come on.
And I said to my dad, and this was probably 63, 64, so I was only 5 years old,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
6 years old. And I said, what is a comic Lenny Bruce?
Yeah.
He said, it means comic.
Yeah.
And this guy's name is Lenny Bruce. I go, well, what is a comic? He said, it's a guy who stands on stage and tells funny jokes.
Yeah.
And I went, oh, I want to do that.
That was it?
Yeah, no, my dad told me that story. He goes, okay, that's what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
And then, but Detroit was a great place to grow up.
What was your dad's business?
My dad was a builder.
Yeah.
He was a builder and he was a home builder and he ended up doing very well. You know, he was from poor Russian family and he ended up, you know, working through the generations of Detroit and did very well.
Your grandparents were Russian immigrants,
yeah,
actually?
Yeah.
Jewish?
Yeah.
Everybody?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's I don't know why I assume that, but I always assume that.
Yeah.
With comedians.
Yeah.
It's a Jewish thing.
And you know, I mean, nobody in my world or my family was in show business.
Right.
But my parents liked it. I'll tell you, there was a thing called the Children's Orthogenic School, which was like for underprivileged kids who had mental deficiencies.
Right, yeah,
you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, my parents became the fundraisers and they would put on a big show every year for the Children's Orthogenic School at Ford Auditorium and they would bring in the guests.
Yeah.
So this was 69, 70, 68 in that area. And this was in another era of show business because like one year, Sonny and Cher were the headliners.
Really?
Yeah. And they had their own network show.
Variety show.
And my mom and my dad and I picked them up at the airport. I mean, this wasn't limos and all that. And I don't know if that was just Detroit, but but they didn't seem, you're picking us up, you know?
Right.
So we pick them up. And Sonny was from Detroit, so he was really excited to be there. And we drop Cher at the Pontchartrain Hotel, and my mom and her go up because my mom wants to see all her wigs or whatever, I don't know. And my dad and Sonny and I go to a place called Lafayette Coney Island, downtown Detroit.
Yeah.
Sonny has to have a Coney, which any Detroiter understands.
It's a hot dog?
Yeah, it's a chili dog with mustard, chili, and onions. And Sonny looks out the window. There's construction in the middle of the street, downtown Detroit. And he gets out, and a guy comes out of the sewer. And Sonny yells, Uncle Davey! And Sonny goes in the middle of the street and hugs this guy that just came out of the sewer. It's his uncle. And we brought in
Steve
Lawrence and Edie Gourmet with their opening act was Richard Pryor.
Really?
And who bombed horribly and said did all these retarded kid jokes that...
Oh, really?
Oh, no, he got himself in a lot of trouble.
You saw that?
Oh, yeah, I was there. I went to the airport and drove him back.
11 or 12?
Yeah, I was probably 11 at that time.
So was he wasn't quite the Richard Pryor
that
we
know. No, he was total unknown. He was an opening act for Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, and he was felt horrible, and he had bombed, and I remember driving him in the car with him. So early on, I kind of sensed that people in show business were different and unique, and I liked how important they were to my parents, you know.
How many kids in your family?
There were four boys.
Yeah?
Four boys. And then my dad remarried, and I had two stepsisters.
So they got divorced?
Yeah, my parents got divorced when I was young, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And did you stay in touch with everybody? Or you have good relationships with
both
of
them? I can
get
any of them on the phone right now, I swear. It will not be a problem. All my brothers and sisters pick up the phone for me. No, I'm the in the larger family, I'm the third. So, but in between my brothers and I, I'm the second.
So when did you decide to do, comedy, if you started that young?
Oh, I was doing stand-up in high school, and I would go up to Ann Arbor and play clubs called the Pretzel Bell, and there was a place called the Delta Lady in Ferndale, Michigan.
No comedy clubs yet at this time.
No, there were no comedy clubs. The first real comedy club was in Detroit at Mark Ridley's Comedy Castle, which I'm sure you know of.
I don't know it.
No, it's been there forever.
It's still there?
That was the first, no, listen. In the big cities, there were the showcases.
Right.
You know,
Catch Rising Star.
And the Comedy Store and the Improv. And up in San Francisco, you could go up and you can get on at the Holy City Zoo. But there hadn't been places that put, a headline comic and really made a night of comedy. And we were all of us, Shanling, Gallagher, and Bruce Baum, and we were all on a show called Make Me Laugh.
Right.
Which came out at the perfect time. It was a syndicated show, and it came out at 11 p.m. at a time when everyone was tired of the news.
Yeah.
It was right before the Iranian hostage situation.
Yeah.
And nobody watched the news for about a year. It was just people. So there was this 11 o'clock strip show, and it was a big hit.
Bobby Vance, right?
Bobby Van. And so Mark Ridley, this guy in Detroit, had the idea. He called me. He said, look, why don't I do a club where, you come in and then I'll have two locals open for you. And it'll be a comedy club, just like the Comedy Store, only not without 15 guys in a night, And then there was one in Cleveland, a guy named Dino Vance, Dino Vince and a couple guys opened the Cleveland Comedy Club. And then it started to take off. You know, there was Columbus and Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Comedy Club, which was managed by a guy named Jimmy Miller, who ended up becoming a huge...
Dennis's brother. Yeah.
And Dennis used to open for me in Columbus, in Cleveland, at the Cleveland Comedy Club, which, in fact, that was Dennis's first road gig.
When he's a prop act?
He was a huge prop act. And we used to tease him about it. It would take 30 minutes to set that damn act up, and then he does it for 15 minutes. And his first road act was opening for me, and then he opened for Coulier for a week,
So when you started doing it when you were like 16 or whatever, were you doing dinner clubs? You opening for musical acts?
No, when I first started, I would go into jazz clubs because that's what I read that Lenny Bruce used to do.
Who were your heroes at that time? Who were you watching?
Woody Allen. Right. I wanted to be Woody Allen my whole life.
You had that record. I did too, when I was younger.
Loved it. The stand-up years.
The stand-up record is amazing.
I shot a moose.
Yeah.
And the moose ate the Berkowitzes.
Right?
And so we, we would go, I would go in, I would take a friend jazz of mine clubs. And we would go to a jazz club and we'd say, hey, I'm a comedian.
Yeah.
And this was,
and
there
kids.
Were no comedians at this time. This right. was in between, this is right before Steve Martin took off nationally. And it was in between Klein and Carlin and Cosby. And stand-up comedy had died.
Right.
It just, there was a rumbling of it I didn't know of. Oh, I became aware of in New York with the Catch a Rising Star,
the
with
improv.
The Richard Lewis and the Ed Bluestones
yeah.
and the David Brenner and that. But
Bluestone, I haven't heard that name
yeah,
in a while.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the improv was
right.
there too.
So I would say, can I go on? And they'd say, yeah, you're a comedian, what the hell is that? And, and the audience didn't know how to react to me, you know, and some nights I'd get them and some nights I wouldn't.
Well, you were like 17.
I was 17.
They must have been like, what's this kid doing up here?
Yeah, yeah. No, it was fun. And sometimes they'd heckle me. One guy said, you're about as funny as my middle leg, you know.
Just middle leg.
You know, it was like, and then I'd be downtown Detroit. That's when I really started to get funny.
Yeah.
Was when I'd be downtown Detroit playing to all black audiences and I would go, you know, okay, a little white boy here. Time for a little white boy to teach you guys what funny is.
Right.
Record scratch, you know. And,
yeah.
And, but it was good. You know, I ended up getting, I would always go on stage to these all black audiences and they'd be like, you know, we're going to eat you alive.
Right. It's hard.
And I'd always end up getting a huge applause at the end because they'd go, he got us, you know, and he worked his ass off.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Because it's a different type of room. You better show up. You better do the job.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I was able to really just, you know, I was disarmed them. It was so different. And I did a lot of jokes about being downtown Detroit from the suburbs.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And, you know, but it was fun. And then at a certain point, as soon as I graduated high school, I left. I drove out to California, you know.
Yeah.
And I ended up at the Comedy Store, you know, and I had.
What year was that? Must have just been what?
77.
Oh, okay. 70. So she'd been at it for about 4 years.
Yeah.
Four years, but it was still the original crew.
Yeah. They were the old guys. You know, I was like the freshman when Robin McLaurin, you know, when I first saw him.
Really?
And he was also from my hometown. So
Robin was?
Yeah, Birmingham, Michigan, you know. So we had a lot in common and
he didn't always go by Robin Williams?
No, first it was Robin McLaurin.
That was his real name?
Yeah.
I never knew that.
Yeah. And
who else was
David
around?
Letterman was around. He was a big bearded guy and George Miller and Tom Dreesen and Elaine Boozler and Ed Bluestone. And
yeah.
That was the crew.
Ollie
then.
Joe.
But Ollie Joe at the time when I first got out here wasn't quite a comedian yet. He was just Ollie Prater.
Yeah.
And he was the doorman and he wasn't funny. And one day he put a cowboy hat on and became Ollie Joe Prater and got funny, you know?
So he was just a door guy.
Yeah, he was just a door guy. And I was a door guy. That was my job.
Well, I was a door guy for a year.
Yeah, I was
there
a
was
door
a
guy.
System in place.
My favorite story is I'm standing in front of the Westwood Comedy Store one night. We had just booked the Saturday show. It was packed.
Yeah.
And a little car pulls up. A little bumbling guy gets out of the passenger seat. He says, there's a table for Neil Israel. His name is The Door. And he's drunk out of his mind. And he's just saying what he was told to say. I go, excuse me? He goes, there's a table for Neil Israel and his name is at the door. And I realize it's Ringo Starr. And he's drunk out of his mind.
Right.
So we seat him. And he way at the back, this table with him and Neil Israel and their wives. And he starts to heckle the shit out of David Letterman, a young David Letterman.
Yeah.
And Letterman just chews the guy up. And the audience doesn't know that it's Ringo Starr.
Does David?
No, but he finally, Ringo tells him, Davis Ringo. And he goes, Ringo who? Ringo Starr. And they really? It's Ringo Starr? He goes, so you're going to fuck my career up like you fucked yours up? You know?
Yeah.
It was a great time. You know, again, I was 18 years old. And
what did they call you? They call you...
Kid Comedy.
Kid
Comedy. And then one night I'm there and Norman Lear comes up to me afterwards. Didn't even know he was there.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, I want you to call me tomorrow. And it was Norman Lear at the time was huge, you know, I mean.
Was Jimmy Walker around then?
Yeah, Jimmy Walker was around. He was the one guy that was a star. He was the only guy that was a star out of that young.
Right.
Yeah, he was. So when he would come in, it would be, oh my God. Then Richard started coming around again. He had been gone for a few years.
Uh-huh.
But after I was there about 2 years, he started coming back.
That must have been amazing to watch.
That was great. That was great. That was really special.
Did you ever tell him you saw him when you were a kid?
Yeah. And he knew the whole story and he remembered it completely.
Oh, really?
And he didn't remember me being in the car. But he remembered the whole night, and then years later, I was on this dinner with Steve Lawrence and Edie Gourmet, and
right.
They remembered it exactly. They were like, "We were so mad at Richie. We were so mad. We had taken him everywhere, and he was horrible that night." And
they remember.
She remembered it. She knew.
So what happened with Norman Lear?
He had me do a pilot. I did a pilot for him called Apple Pie. It was my first, and I'd only been out in town less than a year, and it was a network show that was very short-lived. But it was with Dick Libertini and Rue McClanahan and Jack Gilford and Dabney Coleman.
Wow.
It was an incredible.
And you were like 19?
I was probably not 19 yet, you know?
So you're out here in Hollywood, and the Comedy Store is like in its most exciting time, probably. Jay Leno's around too, I imagine.
Yeah, Jay Leno became like my older brother. He was one of my best friends.
Really?
And
you were a little out of control, right?
Yeah, and that was the problem. You know, Jay was really, really, really great guy to me, but we had a parting of the ways, and. But I used to go to his house with him every night after the show, and we'd watch The Tonight Show and whoever was on, and we'd play Risk, and then I'd get up in the morning, call him, and come over, and we'd hang out all day. And,
right.
You know, and I got sick. I got very sick as a kid. I was doing a lot of drugs, and I was eating a lot of garbage, and I was away from home, and I got a form of colitis.
Uh-huh.
And Leno took me to the hospital late one night and called my dad, and you know, I was in the hospital for about 3 weeks, and he really took care of me and because my father couldn't come out at the time.
Yeah.
And they ended up becoming friends.
Your dad and Jay?
Yeah. Well, and my dad loved old cars and had some old cars.
Uh-huh.
So whenever he would come to Detroit, my dad would let Jay drive around these vintage cars around for his gigs, you know?
Yeah.
And they stayed friends till the day my dad died, you know?
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
But you didn't stay friends with him.
Yeah, I did. We had a falling out of the ways, you know, over the strike, you know?
You were there for that?
Yeah, I was there for the strike, and I just didn't really understand it, you know?
Yeah, because you were like 18.
Yeah, it didn't make sense to me. It felt like everybody was just really mean to Mitzi, and they were playing Bud's Club, and he wasn't paying anything either.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
So I was like, I was there all day shooting a movie. The other thing is I got this role in a CBS movie to play Alan Bursky in the Freddie Prinze story.
Because they couldn't get Bursky to play Bursky?
Yeah, I know. That's Bursky was always mad about it. But I made a mistake, you know. I mean, I really, Jay was such a good friend to mine and Tom Treason. And I just, one night, I just went on. I went, this is stupid. Mitzi talked me into it. And I went on, and I remember going outside, and I could just see Leno was so upset. He goes, they say you went on, but I know you wouldn't do it. I went, no, I did. I went on. I just think the whole thing's stupid.
You didn't quite understand it.
I made a mistake. You know? I mean, it was dumb. It was probably the stupidest thing I ever did in my whole career.
Was being a scab.
Yeah, and it didn't hurt me my career in any way because that wasn't really show business.
Right.
That's what people found out either right away or never found out, that the Comedy Store was not show business. It had nothing to do with show business. I remember years later, I was sitting on the set of a movie and someone from the Comedy Store called me and I just realized, They're not in the business. This is the you know.
Oh, it's its own world.
You know, but it was stupid of me. You
but
know?
How many people? So they at that.
And I also think, you know, at the time, you got to understand my father, you know, was this kind of entrepreneurial Detroit guy who built himself up from nothing, who didn't have any sense of the unions.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was not a union guy.
Yeah.
You know? At the time, in his mind, the unions were destroying Detroit. You
right.
know? And So he was like, I'd call him and I'd say, Dad, there's this thing, and Jay and Elaine Boozer, they're starting a union and they don't want me. Well, Mitchie's been good to you. I go, I know, I don't know what to do, and I'm shooting the movie there. He goes, just fuck these guys.
Yeah.
Fuck these guys.
Yeah.
You know, and it was, you know, it was a mistake because he didn't know what he was talking about. And I should have listened to Jay. And Jay was like really good to me.
You know,
he was really, really good to me as a young guy, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, we stayed friends, and I would go on the Tonight Show when he was on, and you know, we never fought, but you could just see in his eyes he was never as warm to me again. You know,
it's interesting because like that a lot of people don't know about that strike, and I talk about the book a lot. You know, the Nodal Sayer book. You know, I'm dying up here.
I never saw it, but you know, it's funny. I know that there were. People have told me what's in it.
I thought it was a pretty good book.
I was.
What have you heard?
I don't know. I just...
It's all about that. It's about...
I was in London shooting Upside of Anger, and I'd shot like for 18 days, and I'd promised him I'd do this interview, and I was sitting in Hyde Park for maybe 2 hours talking to him about a world that I didn't even remember, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking... I remember just talking about just the way I'm talking to you about it, like... At the time, it was a big deal, but it was only a big deal to us. Nobody, it wasn't like
national news.
Comedy was shut down this week.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Day 114 in the comedy shutdown. No one cared.
Well, it was just guys trying to get paid. And Mitzi was insisting that it was a workshop and didn't want to pay.
Yeah, and in her defense, what it really was, and this is the truth, although I do say that it was stupid to cross a picket line of your peers. I wouldn't do that today.
Yeah.
But it was also fueled on by a lot, by the guy, all the people that didn't get spots.
Right.
You know, all the people that, in her mind, it was a real meritocracy and the best comedians got the best spots.
Right.
And there were a lot of people that weren't getting good spots and said, this is bullshit, we gotta bring her down. And they came to hate her, you know?
Yeah.
And you know, she said, I'll pay you guys $35 a spot, and that wasn't good enough, you know.
Right.
They want and Bud, they were striking from Bud's club, and Bud wasn't paying anything either. It was just the way it was, and you know, it never bothered me that we weren't getting paid, because I felt like it was just high school or just college, and we were getting paid. We were learning, and we were going to get paid up the road, and I felt most of the guy, you know. When the strike started, I spoke to Letterman about it, and he was like, I think it's stupid. I don't think anyone should get paid. This is a showcase.
Right.
And it, you know, and Leno was one of the few guys, Leno and Dreesen and Elaine Boozler. Elaine Boozler wanted to be Norma Rae. You know, she was very passionate about it, but those three were the only real working comics that wanted to strike. Yes, they wanted to do what was right, but what they really, a lot of them just wanted to tear her down. A lot of them, she was a very divisive character. She had her favorites, and if you weren't one of them, you know, she was evil, you know, which I understand. You know, listen, again, like I say, my thing was, it was a great, you know, it was a great place to have gone through, but you stay there after a while, it means you failed. It doesn't mean you're succeeding.
Yeah, it's a little dark. Was it dark back then?
Yeah, it was dark. But Jay used to say that to me. He'd say, you know, you don't understand. The goal is not to get in to the Comedy Store and be a regular and stay there. The goal is to get the hell out of the Comedy Store.
Right.
You know, and a lot of these guys didn't see it that way. And I was really lucky. I was very lucky in the sense that, number one, Make Me Laugh took me on the road.
Yeah.
Playing the comedy clubs and also opening for big names.
Comics and musicians?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, never for comics opening. But I would open for Kenny Loggins. And
that was the gig, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because there was no comedy club, so you get on those concerts.
I'd be on the road. And, you know, I went on the road with Andy Williams one summer.
Really?
You know? Yeah. And, you know,
I think Mitzi used to live in his old house.
No, she lived down the street from him.
Oh, from Andy Williams?
Like two houses away. But
were you like part of the family, though? I mean, Mitzi really took a liking to you.
Yeah.
You'd hang out at the house.
Yeah.
Who was she dating? Like Steve Landisberg?
Steve Landisberg.
At the time.
Yeah, that's right. And I also took care of Paulie and Peter during the day. It was one of my first jobs.
To babysit?
Yeah. But again, when you run into any of the Shores, when you run into, they talk about the strike as if it was, you know, I had this guy, I'm not going to say his name, but he came over to my office and he had wanted to show me old photos and books. And,
yeah.
And he we changed history. We were at the apex. Do you realize? I just, no, we didn't. We didn't. Honestly, I'm sorry. But the strike, us, that time period. No, it was a pinnacle of American comedy. No. You know, I mean.
Well, you know what the one thing is that the door deal in the store in the main room still holds. Oh, so yeah. On a good night, you can make a couple $100.
Yeah, that's right. That was great. And that actually, she had agreed to do that, but they still wanted to strike. I mean,
did you know Libitkin?
Yeah, sure.
And he was like, he was an unstable guy anyways, huh?
I never saw it like that. But obviously, when you jump off a hotel building, you're unstable. You know, stable guys actually just check into the hotel and go to sleep. You know, the unstable ones jump off the roof. I mean, especially when you're jumping off because you're not getting spots at the Comedy Store.
Okay? It's a problem.
All right, you know, I mean, and they wanted to turn Libitkin into a living legend or a hero, a martyr. But the fact is, I'm sorry. You know, when your homeland is taken over, maybe then you light yourself on fire and, you know, but when you don't get spots at a local comedy club, it's, you know, the jumping off a building is a decision you made to end your life, and I'm not going to turn you into any great hero, you know, because sure. You are. You're a little unstable.
Right.
And but he was a great guy. I mean, I didn't know him well, but he was always nice to me.
Yeah.
But I never saw it as, like, why would you do that over the strike?
Yeah.
You know, I've always felt that, you know, whenever, listen, I've had some suicide in my family, yeah. You know, and. The best line when I, and there's a great AA line, you kill yourself, you five down.
Five years.
You killed the wrong guy.
Yeah, if you kill yourself in the first 5 years of sobriety, you're killing the wrong guy.
Well, Steve Libitkin, if he had lived 4 days, he would have realized he killed the wrong guy.
Right.
You know, that was not a good reason, you know.
Sure.
Unless there was other stuff going on.
Right.
Which we never know, you know. When someone kills himself, God bless them, because you just don't know. But in terms of, people were saying he did it to shine a light on the injustice at the Comedy Store. And I was like, that's the wrong light.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, yeah, it haunted that place forever. So you're doing the comedy, the make me laugh thing happened. So now you're getting work, you're making a living in show business.
Yeah.
Can you just substantiate some story? Was there a story where you were on the roof of the Comedy Store and you pulled a billboard down?
Yeah.
What was that?
That was funny. That was there was a guy right across the street from the Comedy Store. Yeah. It was in a different era. I don't think he could do this anymore, but he bought an ad. It was an actor, and he bought the billboard of himself, you know, Dan Davis, actor.
Yeah.
And it was him, and he was in his head stuck above the billboard. And we went out in the middle of the night, and we tied a rope around his head. And we sawed the head off just enough so that a good tug it would come off, and had the rope across the string, and you know, had the audience go to the window, and we all pulled the rope and just pulled the guy's head right off. You know, it was the billboard just was driving me crazy. I was doing like 10 minutes a night on the fact that a guy, look at this guy.
In the original room? You could see it out of the original
room. Yeah, you could see out of the window, you know, and everybody waiting in line saw it coming in, so they knew who Dan Davis did. And it was a great piece, and it just built to the point where Harris Pete and I rigged this thing up, and we pulled this guy's...
From across the street.
Yeah, Blake Clark and I, we climbed up during the day, and you know, thank God one of us didn't fall. You know, it was crazy, but it was a fun time.
That was a good performance piece.
Yeah, it was great.
So when did you, like, because your career is so varied, and you know, you've had a long one, and you've done a lot of amazing things. So what is that moment like? Where did the cleaning up coincide with stopping comedy?
Yeah,
it did.
I was playing the clubs and traveling and. And when I was about 25, I was doing a lot of drugs and alcohol. And did you know a comedian named Jesse Aragon?
Maybe his picture. Like, I knew Harris briefly because I was a doorman in 87. Like, I got there, like, late. So, like,
your
generation was already, like, a mythology. Yeah. You know, like, you guys established the mythology of the place, but it still sort of operated that way. And Harris was sort of still around. And Blake was still around, but they were, you know, in their 40s.
Yeah. Well, we...
Jesse Aragon.
Jesse was the first guy that got sober in AA, and I was in town, and I needed some pot or something. He said, I'm sober. How'd you do that? And he took me to an AA meeting, and I didn't like it. And some guys followed me out and said, "What's the problem?" you know. And I said, "Well, first of all, I'm a Jew, and you have your meetings in churches,
right?
So we'll start from there. Second of all, I'm not really sure. I don't want to smoke pot. I just don't want to drink anymore.
Do blow?
I don't know. But the fact is, it started to work for me.
Yeah,
I started going to these Uncle John's men's pancake house luncheons on the west side, and guys were funny, and I got sober, and you know, I just went off the road, and I was, it was all the other side thing that took me away from comedy was the fact that I was getting acting work, and I also wrote I had done a special for HBO, which really cut my ties completely with the Comedy Store. I did a concert in Detroit with me, Dave Coulier, Paul Rodriguez, and Howie Mandel.
So it was a comedy special.
It was called the Detroit Comedy Jam. But it was just a live series of concerts we did, which did very well.
And you produced it?
I produced it. I put it all together and hosted it.
Yeah.
And Chris Albrecht was my agent at the time at ICM.
Chris Albrecht, who actually started as a doorman at the Improv New York.
In New York, yeah.
And went on to head HBO.
Yeah, but he went on to become
an agent
at ICM and handled a lot of comedians. And I brought him back to show him this big show we did, and he said, "Let's do this as a special." And it was an HBO special called The Detroit Comedy Jam, and Mitzi was like, "You're doing, that's my shit you're doing." I go, "What, guys with a microphone? I don't understand. What part is yours? It's in Detroit. It's in a concert hall." You shouldn't be a producer. You should just be a comedian and let me produce that. I said, okay. And so apparently she hated me for that for a long time.
Oh, really? That was it?
Yeah, that was it. And
that's interesting.
So I did this thing called the Detroit Comedy Jam, and then I did... The guy that bought the specials from HBO at the time and took them to colleges was a guy, I'm bummed that I'm breaking his name because he was such a great guy, but he also ran Columbia TriStar Home Video, and he would make little independent movies, and he made Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Drugstore Cowboy. His name's going to come back to me. I'm just blanking. It's one of those brain farts. But anyway, he had sold my special to HBO. I wrote a script called The Bridge.
Yeah.
Which was me and my friends growing up in Detroit and LA, in Detroit in the early 70s, getting into some trouble. It was a real coming of age piece. And Bobby took it to this guy, and he said, "I'll if you want to make it for $3 million, I'll let you make this movie." And he gave me $3 million through Bobby Neumeier, the guy who did Sex, Lies, and Videotape.
Yeah.
And we went to Minneapolis, and we kind of recreated my childhood.
Yeah. And you wrote the script.
I wrote the script, and I directed the movie. It was a little $3 million movie. And Josh Charles was the star. He played me, and Stephen Baldwin was in it. And it became Crossing the Bridge, and Touchstone bought it. Disney bought it.
Yeah.
And that kind of changed my life in the sense that, you know, it was a little movie. It didn't make any money. It got great reviews.
Right.
But it got me going. You know, Jeffrey Katzenberg said, "What do you want to do next?" And I said, "I want to do this piece about my childhood at camp up in Canada." Katzenberg and Eisner watched my movie late one night at Eisner's house and said, "This is our childhood. You know, let's buy this."
Oh, right.
And they bought it, and then I went into a meeting with them and said, "What do you want to do next?" I said, "I want to do this thing called Indian Summer."
And that was a big movie for you. I mean, that was a big movie. It had an amazing cast.
Yeah, and it did well. It was like the number two or three movie for 2 weeks in a row, which at the time was a big deal. It was at a time when Touchstone was trying for a lot of singles and doubles and weren't doing big movies.
Right.
It was a program that they quickly discarded.
Yeah.
But again, I made the movie for $9 million. It made like maybe $30 million or something for them.
How did you get on your feet with all that stuff around, you know, directing and producing? I mean, you just took to it, or did you hire good ADs? Who guided you through that?
I had written this movie called Coupe de Ville. Mm-hmm. That was the other, I skipped that. So I was cleaned up, stopped doing stand up.
Did you miss it?
Nah, at first I did, yeah. At first I did. But I didn't want to be in the clubs until I felt
right,
really good,
stable.
But I was writing, and I always, from day one, I was always writing screenplays. I wrote so many of them, and I wrote this script based on a true story in my family about my dad and his two brothers taking a Cadillac down to Florida. And Larry Bresner, who was Robin's manager,
yeah,
who I knew through Robin, read it and helped me get it made, and he really godfathered my whole career. He really became my mentor, and he got the movie made. You know, a guy named Joe Roth directed it, who ended up becoming right, the big head of the studios. And
that was Coupe de Ville.
That was Coupe de Ville. So I had a produced screenplay.
Right.
And then I wrote this other one, which was another three guys in a car. We got Stephen Baldwin, Jason Gedrick, and Josh Charles, and Grown Up in Detroit. And it was really an era. And I got it made, and like I said, Katzenberg and Eisner liked it, so they gave me a big deal at Disney, which that...
And you directed that one, though. That was
I directed the second one. It became Crossing the Bridge.
And how did you learn how to direct?
You don't. You just bullshit. Yeah. You just bullshit, you
yeah,
know?
I mean, get a good AD.
I was on the set of the Coupe de Ville, and yeah, I watched Joe Roth, and I thought, if this guy can do it, I can do it,
right,
you know? And I got a good AD, and I got Bobby was a good producer.
Yeah.
He had worked with first-time directors, and he got me a really great... I mean, my DP, the director of photography, was a guy named Tom Siegel,
Good DP, that's important.
He became Thomas Newton Siegel.
And then
he became a big time DP. He is a big time DP.
Well, those are the guys that really, like, as a director, I don't know why I was saying AD, but the DP, he's the guy where you go, well, this is what I want. And he's like, all right, we can do it from here and from here,
right,
and then we'll do that.
Right.
Okay,
that's
good.
Right. That's right. So the truth is, you can direct if you admit you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
And that's what Bobby and Sharon Bialy, my first casting director, who is still casting every movie I've ever done, they said, don't pretend you know what you're doing. Just ask for help. And so I did, and I just made the movie. And then this Indian summer, we went back up to my old summer camp, and Sam Raimi, who was a kid in my cabin, was one of the stars of the movie. And it was really, it was just, again, I spent the first few years just recreating my life, you know, in sequence.
That Sam Raimi was a childhood friend of yours?
Oh, yeah. Sam and I were friends since we were little kids. We still are to this day. You know, he's one of my best friends.
He's a good director.
Yeah, he's a good director.
Do you guys talk about that stuff?
About what stuff?
Directing?
Yeah, we talk about how much more successful he is than I am, how much more money he has. You know.
But you're still friends. That's good.
Yeah, yeah. He's and he was great in the movie. He played this weirdo maintenance guy that we kind of knew. He was aping a guy we knew.
Oh, really?
He was brilliant. You know, him and Alan Arkin did these incredible physical scenes together. And
that must have been amazing working with Arkin at, you know, just second time out directing. And
well, I worked with, he was in my first movie that I wrote, Coupe de Ville.
He was in Coupe de Ville.
He's in Coupe de Ville, and he was in Indian Summer.
He's hilarious.
He's
man.
Hilarious. He's an incredible guy. And so anyway, by that point, I had to say, okay, you know, what happened was I got another HBO special out of my special, a one-night stand they wanted me to do, you know, and I got a gig opening for, I believe, the Pointer Sisters at Caesar's Palace.
Uh-huh.
And at the same time, I was prepping this movie, you know, and I did the one night stand, and I did Caesar's Palace, but there was it's funny, in the one night stand, I shot it in Chicago. They would do two one night stands in one
right.
night at these little concert clubs.
Was it an hour or a half hour?
It was a half hour.
Yeah, right.
So Ellen DeGeneres did a half hour, and I did a half hour. And I just, between that, and then I had to go back to Vegas, and then I had to go and prep this movie, and it was too much. I was stressed out,
yeah,
And again, I didn't want to drink, you know? So something had to go. So the last stand-up I ever really did, other than a benefit with Jay for Charlie Hill, the last stand-up I ever did in my life was Caesar's Palace. You know, I played Caesar's Palace with the Pointer Sisters, and it was good, and I did that half-hour HBO thing, and I just said, okay, you know, I'm not that good at it. You know, I mean, I'm basically doing the same act I always was. And if I go with the movies, I think I have a chance to really, you know,
be creative
and do a new thing every year. And I made a conscious decision, and I was probably 28 or 29 years old at the time. And I never did it again, you know, and it was such a big part of my life that I thought it was going to be hard to quit, you know, because it becomes a drug that need to get up every night.
Exactly.
Did you get up? I'm going out. Can I get up?
Yeah.
You know, and to the point of years later, I'd go into comedy clubs.
Yeah.
And I'd be sitting in the back, and someone would come up and goes, the owner wants to know if you want to get up. No. I'd say, I'm just, you know, do you want to get up? When you get far enough away from it, it's alien again to get on stage.
So sure. And probably terrifying.
Well, the other thing that really became great was I would go to see comedy shows, even in that quick time after I quit, and go, yeah, he's funny. Oh, yeah. Oh, I wish that's a good joke.
Yeah.
But after a couple of years, I'd be there laughing my ass off with the crowd. And I forgot how great it was to love comedy.
Right. You get cynical, yeah.
Because, you know, I remember some of the magician friends I had, they just watch it and look at how the trick's done, you know? And that's what happens, you know? And I got back into this thing where I'm a great audience member.
Yeah.
I laugh my ass off at a funny comedian.
Yeah.
And I got that back.
Oh, that's a gift.
So by the time I was 30, you know, I was making a movie every year.
Yeah.
I was doing things, and I didn't miss it at all. And it was also, I guess, really the only stand-up that I stayed really good friends with was Tim Allen and Dave Coulier.
Yeah.
Because they were Detroit guys, you know?
How's Tim doing?
Tim's doing really good.
Good.
Yeah, we just went down to the opening of The Broad together.
Oh, how was that place? Beautiful?
It's beautiful, yeah. Eli Broad is my godfather.
He is?
Yes, he's from Detroit, too. And he was my dad's best friend growing up all his whole life. And so I know him very well.
And he's still around?
He's still around, yeah.
And this is his collection?
Yeah.
Is that the idea?
He basically gave a $1 billion gift to the city of Los Angeles.
Did he live out here?
He lived out here for many years. He still does.
And he was friends with your father growing up?
Yeah.
And so he's got this, so you knew a lot of the art from his house?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I know them very well. I've traveled with them. And
yeah.
And I mean, they're part of our family, you know?
And do you have kids?
Yeah, I do.
How many?
I have a 21-year-old son and a 22-year-old daughter.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are you married to the same mom?
Same mom. I've been married to the same woman for 28 years.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations on that.
Thanks. Yeah, it's great. I've been sober 31 years.
That's incredible, man.
And, you know, I met her at the bank where the Comedy Store writes the checks on. And I'd come in all messed up. And
to cash the check?
Cash the check. And, can I see the manager's bullshit? What are you bouncing my checks for? And then this 20-year-old blonde manager would come over. She was so hot.
Yeah.
But she was such a bitch.
Yeah.
And I used to call her the bitch at the bank.
Yeah.
You know? And I actually moved to another branch because this woman was so hard on me.
Yeah.
And I just had this total crush on her, but she was... But I was a screw-up.
Yeah.
I was a screw-up. I mean, I was... All my checks were for $90 to the same person.
Right.
Figure that out, you know?
Yeah.
And Domino's Pizza.
Right.
That was it. Yeah. And she would look through these and she'd go, Mr. Binder, you know, you got to keep money in your account if you're writing these checks. And she could just see. She knew. And I got sober and I ran into her at an AA meeting.
Uh-huh.
And she had been sober a few years longer than me. And she just knew me as a deadbeat at the bank, but she was like, I am so glad you got sober. And we started dating, and I married the bitch at the bank, you know? Yeah.
It's sweet.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
But like these, like the number of movies you made is pretty astounding to me. I mean, you made a lot of movies. And then you did this series.
And a couple of them are good.
No, I mean,
that's the thing. I mean, I really had to flounder because I didn't have any training and I didn't really, all I knew was Woody Allen and those guys, you know. But, you know, it's been a real great experience making movies because it's like doing an hour and then you get it and you get it done and then you start over with nothing again every year.
Right. Know? But like the directors I've talked to and like the process of it, it's, you know, you're all in for a couple of years.
Yeah. You know, listen, some of them take 5-6 years to get made. And some of them, I write a lot of scripts and a lot of them. But by the time you know you're going to make it, you're all in for a year.
Now,
it's a year.
When you do, you wrote Blank Man?
No, I didn't. Blank Man was an aberration. It's the only movie I've ever done that I didn't write.
You just directed it?
Yeah. Damon and I were friends from the Comedy Store. And
he used to be so good, didn't he?
He still is.
Yeah.
He still is, man. He's a great stand-up comic.
When I was a doorman there, he would come in and just do this free-form shit.
Oh, he was brilliant. What happened was after Indian Summer, I had gotten, Disney wanted me to do another movie. And it was that weekend, I ran into Damon at the theater. He was there watching the movie. And he said, "You want to do this Blank Man?" And it was like a Batman parody.
Yeah, I remember.
And I loved Batman growing up. And Sam had just done Dark Man, which, you know. And so I said, yeah. And my agent, Jim Burke, at the time said, "This is going to kill your career." And I said, "It's not my movie. I'm producing a friend's, it's like a producing a friend's album."
Yeah.
Why am I going to, if it doesn't do well, it's his fault.
Right.
And I said, we're going to make it funny as hell. He said, "It's going to kill you." And Jeff Katzenberg called me and said, "Don't do this. Don't do." And I said, "Look, I want to work with Damon." And I gave him a year of my life. It was the best year. Comedy, Damon, Alan Grier and I, we laughed our ass off. We made a movie that tested through the roof that Sony thought was going to be a huge hit. And Damon was really funny in it. And it was a really good version of that thing and a Batman spoof. And it bombed.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get a movie made for 3 years. it killed my career. And my agent was, "I told you so," you know?
Did he stay your agent?
Yeah.
And then you come back with one of your own movies or no?
Yeah, no. Then I made a little small little movie. I had to kind of reinvent myself. I made this little movie called Sex Monster with myself as the star and Meryl Hemingway. I made it for $600,000.
Yeah.
And that kind of got me going again, you know.
Did anyone go see it?
I don't know if anyone went and saw it, but I don't even think it was released. I think HBO bought it as well. It went up. To the Aspen...
Comedy and Arts Festival.
Right. And it won Best Picture, and I won Best Actor, and Chris Albrecht said, "You got to do a show for us," which became Mind of the Married Man.
Yeah, I like that
show.
So
they bought that movie, and they bought the show, and so that's what it... It never really was in theaters, but it helped me a lot, and it changed my... You know, it kind of moved me to another direction. And I worked on the show, which to me was just little movies, you know?
Yeah.
And I had total creative control. And
what happened to that? How many of you did? What, two seasons?
Yeah.
With Bobby Slayton?
Bobby Slayton was great in
it. He was great in it.
Yeah.
He still wishes it was going.
Slayton, he sent me the funniest thing. When the show got canceled, he wrote me a note. "Binder, thanks for having me in your show. In retrospect, little more of me, a little less of you, we'd still be on the air. Slayton."
What happened with that show?
I don't know. You know, I mean, the show was a little snake bit from the get-go, you know? I mean, we aired Tuesday, September 11th, 2001.
Okay.
I was on the air. We were in New York. We had a premiere party September 10th in New York City. In the morning, I got up on September 11th, and I go on. I'm sitting with Diane Sawyer on the air showing clips from the show that airs tonight.
Yeah.
And she's in the middle of my interview. She says, "Excuse me, but we're going to break away to a news thing now. And the news is Charles Gibson saying that a small plane's hit the World Trade Center."
You were on the air on a panel, yeah, on a show.
And Good Morning America.
Before they knew what was happening, really.
Yeah, yeah. And yeah, they actually still show that interview on the anniversaries of...
oh, really?
For ABC, Good Morning America, where they take you back and show you. And Diane Sawyer, you know, so the show came out and, you know, it was one of those things that was supposed to be a male Sex in the City. And it was very real, but... A lot of women had problems with it, and a lot of guys had problems with it. You know,
you're like, why are you talking about it?
Yeah, there was that. When why talk about it? And this ain't, or the other group was, this ain't, that ain't me. That ain't, yeah, this is puerile. This is in juvenile.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like what I learned from that show, because we did good work. You know, it was really good actors, and Bruce Paltrow directed it. And I mean, it was, we did good. A married man, white man's sexuality is the third rail of American comedy. In fact, any married man.
Yeah.
You know, Chris Rock did this thing, I Think I Love My Wife. I went, you're dead. Yeah. I ran into him at a premiere of one of my movies. He told me that was the title. I said, change that title and that movie's not going to work. Because women don't want to see a movie about a married guy that wants to fuck someone other than their wife.
Right.
And they don't want that. You can't go, you don't go with, in packs with your friends to see that. And the wives don't go, oh, that he just wanted to go see that movie with the guys all fuck masseuses.
Yeah.
Whereas we don't, guys go, okay, Sex in the City movie, you guys all went and you had fun and the girls all got laid by studs. That's fine. That's just come home on time. You know, we don't care.
Yeah,
but guys would tell me I have to pretend I'm asleep when my wife walks in the room when Mine and the Mary's on, on, couldn't. Or else we're gonna get in a fight talking about. Do you think that way? Do you? You know,
so, no shit. So it couldn't go either way.
Yeah. So it's just not a, you know, and just in general, anytime you've tried to do that kind of, anyone who does that kind of horny men thing, you know? So we were, you know, listen, our ratings were really good, you know, and some people liked us and some people hated us, you know, and it was also as a time at HBO that they really started getting into star fucking, and they bought some really expensive shows. So they didn't have the money to do a third season, but they hired me to write it. And I went off and did Upside of Anger.
Was that the one with Kevin Costner?
Yeah.
That did all right,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it did very well. Yeah. That really...
And you were in it?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you play a sleazy guy?
Yeah, I played a sleazy guy.
With the mustache?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Funny, yeah.
That's right. And you know, when I came back, Chris was like, okay, maybe we should do a third season. And he hemmed and hawed, and I started this movie with Ben Affleck called Man About Town. And by the time that was done, you know, they take a year. It was too far away. You know, a lot of the actors had series. And so that's what happened. You know, it was one of those shows that either you loved it or you hated it. And the people that hated it were really loud about hating it.
Men and women.
Yeah. It was a lot of our biggest problems were men
sure.
reviewers.
Why don't you know? Keep your mouth shut.
It wasn't that. There were a few of those, but there were a lot of these guys that just, you know, they don't have that camaraderie with other guys, and they don't sit around and talk about pussy. And
yeah.
Guys don't talk like that. And this is just his, you know, these are sick guys, you know. And the truth is, a lot of guys do. I would be out running.
Yeah.
And I'd see a guy park a car, he'd pull me over, and he'd run alongside me and go, dude, you're giving away all the secrets, right. You know. And I had more guys, you know, tell me that. And I also found it to be a good Rorschach test.
Uh-huh.
The people, when I would run into a married couple and they watched it and liked it, and there were a lot of them.
Yeah.
I always knew they had a good marriage.
Right.
You know, because my wife, she didn't understand. She'd go, what? Why do women get so upset? You think I don't know that he thinks like this?
Yeah.
You think I don't know the way these guys behave when we're not around?
Yeah.
You know? So, anyway, it was, you know, listen, it should have gone longer, but it was perfect for me because it was time for me to move on again, you know. It was, like I say, Upside of Anger really helped me out a lot, and then I made this movie with Ben Affleck, and then I made Rain Over Me with Adam Sandler.
That was a 9/11 movie.
That was a, more or less a 9/11 movie.
Aftermath.
It was like about a story of what happened 3 years later. And it had to do with the fact that I was there that night and on the streets with people covered with dust and sitting around telling stories on curbs about what they'd seen. And then I came back about a year and a half later with my family, and I thought, man, because there were some people that night walking the streets of 2001 that were, you could tell, you just look at them and go, their lives are ruined. They lost somebody. They were just mumbling.
Yeah, I lived in Astoria then. It was devastating. The weeks after with the pictures everywhere.
It was devastating.
The smell and the, ugh.
So about a year and a half later, I was there and I thought, I wonder, there are probably some people still wandering these streets that night never ended for. And I just wrote this piece, and I wasn't going to do it with Tom Cruise and Javier Bardem. And Tom wanted to do it, and Javier wanted to do it, and whatever happened, it ended up Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle, which was fine. And we had a great time making it, and it was a very tough movie, and we showed it to the surviving families and groups, and
yeah,
they loved it. And Adam was really quite good in it, you know? And
yeah.
With anyone else in it, it would have been, people would say it did really good. You know, it made $24-25 million. I make my movies small.
Yeah.
But Adam's, a $24-25 million Adam Sandler movie is a bomb, you know?
But it was a different type of movie for him.
Yeah, yeah. And he knew that, but he took it so personal.
Yeah.
I mean, I was just talking to this about somebody because I think he was really good in all those kind of movies he did. But because none of them were big box office
hits,
he kind of turned back to his, you know, Jack and Jill and Zardoz and, you know, whatever that, know. And I think he just said, fuck it, I'm safe here and this is what my fans want. And I think he could really have been like Tom Hanks. I think that's how talented that guy is.
Yeah.
You know, he really didn't want to go that direction.
Hmm.
And by the time he did, he tried a few other things. They just didn't work. You know?
And that movie did all right. It was a little heavy. I remember I didn't see it because I thought it was heavy.
It did all right. It did all right. But the interesting thing about all these movies, and I'm sure not just my movies, but they have these incredible afterlives now.
Yeah.
So it's almost like a book, and the audience, the theatrical release is just a way to get the publicity out. I mean, I just did this movie Black or White with Kevin Costner, which I think between Canada and America did $25 million at the box office, and we made it for $7 million. But it's doing so well on Netflix and iTunes and Amazon.
Uh-huh.
People are coming up to me all the time talking about that movie. So, and it'll be around forever. You know, I got a text last night from some guy said, I watched the movie and then we went and rented Upside of Anger, you know? So in the old days, you didn't have that.
Right.
You know, if the movie didn't work, the movie didn't work. And maybe it would play on HBO late at night or, you know, but now the movie comes out and within a month it's going everywhere around the world and people can watch it on their big screens at home. And I mean, we've made a lot more money on Black or White than we made at the box office already in television.
Isn't that amazing?
You know? Yeah.
So that the whole paradigm is shifting and it just kind of, and it didn't lose money, but it seems like none of your movies, They seem to
none
do all right.
None of my movies ever lose money.
Yeah.
Because, again, I made that movie for $9 million. Louisiana gave us $2 million back. Kevin put up most of the money. Kevin and I own that movie.
Yeah.
You know, he obviously owns a lot more than I do. But we own the movie forever, you know? And you know, it's just a new, you're as you say, a paradigm. And believe me, within a blink, within at the most 2 years, movies will come out same date, same place, everywhere in the world, everywhere you can buy a movie. Just like an album.
Yeah.
You know, Beyonce puts out an album. You can buy it anywhere
online.
You want,
right,
anywhere
right.
in the world, yeah. online. But a movie, there's still this antiquated distribution where it doesn't come to Canton, Ohio for 6 months.
Yeah.
And it doesn't go to Belgrade.
Yeah.
And doesn't, you know, Belfast for 3 years sometimes.
Yeah.
And that's, the internet has made the world so small.
But you're not hung up on the theater experience?
I'm not at all. No, not one bit. I mean, people, I like the idea that eventually a movie will come out in the theater and you can go that opening weekend, or for the opening weekend, you can pay a premium and watch it on iTunes for $49,
right.
You know?
With the family.
With the family.
Which would be cheaper, about a night. Yeah, a little bit, know? Yeah.
And then eventually that price will come down and it'll come out of the theaters, but it'll open in the whole world and you can watch it on your iPad or your phone anywhere, anytime. And that's where we're getting to. And for me, I can tell you that I've had great experiences in my sitting room with my wife and kids watching movies that are just as good as going out to the theater.
Uh-huh.
And then I like to go to the theater sometime. But it really has nothing to do with the size of the movie or how.
Sure.
It really is, you know, sometimes.
What's your work ethic, man? Because like you know, I talk to writers and I got my own problems with writing, but it seems like you can't help yourself. I mean, you know, I didn't know what we were going to talk about, and I knew we were going to talk about movies and comedy, but then you send me a book. You write a novel.
I have a novel coming out February 1st.
Is that your first novel?
Yes, my first novel.
You just can't stop working.
No, it's really sad.
No, it's not. It's a pretty good compulsion to have.
It's really funny. I went to Aspen this weekend for this Charlie Rose weekend that he has. And I was lucky enough to fly in a private plane on the way back with these people. And after about 20 minutes, I said, I'm going to go back and write. And the guy who's a builder said, yeah, you did that on the way out here. I said, yeah. He goes, are you under some heavy deadline? I went, no, I'm a neurotic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I have to write every day.
Yeah, you do. You know?
Yeah.
That's a fucking gift.
It's a gift. I've really, you know, it's been a great gift for me. It's, first of all, I mean, it's a God-given gift. I really don't take it for granted.
Yeah.
And that I always have an idea.
Yeah.
I've never run out of ideas.
Well, that's a lot like Woody Allen.
I've had so many scripts in the drawer that I finished and I'll do another rewrite. And I write every day.
And you like it?
I do. I love it. I write every day. It's a little bit of a torture because it's like sometimes it's like a shit that won't come out. You know, you just got to squeeze, you know?
Yeah.
And you got to really work it, you know? And sometimes they come out like just, you know, like black or white. I had that idea in my head for 8 years. It was based on a true story that tangentially affected my life, and the fact that my wife had this nephew, a biracial kid named Sean, who we just loved, whose mother died, and he had us up in Santa Monica, his family up there, and the family down in South Central. And I always thought that'd be a great story to tell, a little kid, and I thought, do a custody battle, which we didn't have. And it rolled around in my head for years, and then when I went to write it, it took 3 weeks. And Costner just went, okay, we're doing it this summer, you know, and sometimes they come out like that, and sometimes it's a struggle, but I always have an idea. And I get up every morning, you know, I get up and I have some quiet time and some prayer and meditation, and I get it together, you know, and I spend 3 to 4 hours writing, and it's noon.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'm done. You
right.
know, you know, and then I put some serious time into masturbation.
Sure.
Which makes sense.
You got to keep that. Yeah. Those two things.
That's what keeps you young, ass Ernest Borgnine. You know?
Yeah.
I have the whole day, basically, and business stuff, unless I'm shooting. I don't write when I'm shooting.
Do you have a movie in the works now?
I do. I have two movies in the works, but I have this novel coming out called Keep Calm.
And it's a thriller.
It's a thriller, and I'm making a movie with New Line, with Chuck Roven and Alex Gartner at Atlas are producing it, and these are the guys that did The Dark Knight.
Who you got signed up for stars?
Well, we're just putting it together now, so I don't want to say.
It sounds like a big movie.
It is a big movie. It's like a $60 million action film.
Holy shit.
So it's different for me.
That's the biggest movie you've done, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. It's big. But it's also, the book is a real departure for me. The book is, it's an American who's at number 10 Downing Street and a bomb goes off and he's framed for it. And he realizes right away, once it goes off, that's why I was invited. Because he's got a pass that yeah. would say they're going to
make him a suspect.
They're going to blame it on me. And now, before tonight, by the end of the night, they're going to kill me.
Yeah.
They're going to, and then they're just going to be this guy, this nut did it.
Right.
And so it's him trying to figure out how to stay alive while a young inspector in SO16, which is the anti-terror,
yeah.
this young girl is chasing him across England because she knows he didn't do it. And she knows there's something behind it.
So you could get a real action guy for this.
Oh, yeah, I will. And the young woman inspector, Steele, is a great character, which it's going to be a trilogy. I've already got all three stories.
It's a new Bourne identity.
Yeah, and the girl.
So the guy's going to run for three.
No. He doesn't run for 3 years. He gets to sit down for a minute.
Okay.
But yeah, it's... And so I'm working on that, and, you know, I'm just really lucky, like you say. I've always got... the next thing coming out, and I just wrote a script for Reese Witherspoon based on a book that she loved called Napkin Notes.
Now, she reached out to you?
I think she did, yeah.
It's amazing to me because the reason I like to talk about comedy and just about your place in my mind is that, you know, you lock people in, and I think that's sort of the fear of staying in comedy on one level and also how you're perceived.
Right.
And, you know, I talk to a lot of guys that, you know, started in comedy, but it's rare, you're rare, that, you know, went on to do this, all these amazing things. And I think you have to attach some of it to the introduction into show business is through comedy.
That's right.
It's sort of interesting how everyone's going to do their career and now how they're going to make the break, you know?
I think so. You know, I mean, and by the same token, I've just, it's been an evolving journey for me that I would like to now, I really like writing novels. You know, I'd like to create some television shows. I'm working on Ray Donovan now, you know, and.
As what?
As a writer.
Uh-huh.
And I'd like to get into that world a little bit.
You'll still do staff writing? Or are you doing, you know, you're on staff over there?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I've never done it, but I'm doing it.
Yeah.
And I did it for about 8 weeks on one of Chuck Lorre's sitcoms and realized that I had to get the hell out real fast.
Which one?
Mom.
Yeah.
I mean, the writers were brilliant, but, you know, that whole Chuck Lorre world is a piece of work. And
well, do you like writing comedy?
No.
Right.
No, I didn't like that, but they were geniuses.
Yeah.
They were incredible. And so when they called me about Ray Donovan, I was first like, oh, I already tried this. But I love the show. And I thought, okay, this is a little bit more in the type of show I would create if I did a show.
Right.
But you know, so I just see it as evolving to the books and more movies. And, you know, eventually, you know, I don't want to stay at one place. And I probably would have been more successful if I just did one thing over and over again with
maybe
one kind of movie or whatever. But by the same token, you know, it's really hard for me to do something unless I love it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you understand that.
Yeah, it's a horrible thing to be have to do something. Well, it's not why we signed up for this.
Also, and when I'm looking at you, you know, you've created this whole world for yourself. And
yeah.
You've created your show and you do your stand up and you just do your own shit.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm better off just doing my own shit.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it just makes sense. But I can't do it unless it's like, okay, yeah, I'm really into this. I'm really into this. You
right.
know?
Yeah. But do you ever get to that point, though, where you've gotten yourself into something and you just overwhelmed? Like it sounded to me like when you had to let go of comedy, there's that time where you just stretch too thin and yeah. you got to pick it.
There's only so much bandwidth.
Yeah,
I don't care
I
who you are.
Right.
I don't
right.
care who you are. And that's why I think guys like Woody Allen have been really smart. And, you know, it's really funny. I'm friends with Albert Brooks. You
yeah.
know, we go
tell him to come on the show already, will you?
He's never coming on the show.
All right.
But we go for walks. I'm no offense, but he
doesn't like to talk about himself.
Yeah, yeah. You know, we go for walks in the neighborhood. He's very smart. You know,
yeah.
I say, why aren't you doing another Albert Brooks movie? And Netflix, Amazon, anyone would let you make a movie. I'm concentrating on the acting thing.
Yeah.
You know, he understands he's only got so much bandwidth. You
right.
know? And I've come to those places in my life. And I one of the things that I've been good at is I get a green light and I start a movie, that's all I work on.
Right.
For the duration of the movie. You know, when I get back and I'm in the editing room, I'm writing something else. But while I'm making the movie, while I'm shooting it, while I'm casting it, you know, that's what I do, you know?
Yeah.
So you have to really put blinders on,
yep.
You know?
Yep. Well, you're making a good living in show business.
Yeah. I mean, I'm lucky.
Yeah.
I'm lucky. I mean, I will tell you also that I had almost 5 years where I didn't make a dollar in show business in the middle of my...
After Blank Man?
No. I had 3 years then, and then I got on a roll. But after Rain Over Me, I didn't make a movie for 5 years.
What'd you do? Wrote? Did you think about going back to comedy?
I did a lot, no. I opened up a hot dog joint on Sunset Boulevard.
You did?
I did that. That was fun. But then that was fun.
Did it stay open?
No. It was open for a couple of years.
Detroit style?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Next to the Whiskey A Go-Go. It was called Coney Dog.
Oh, yeah.
But then I realized that this isn't just me hiding, you know?
Yeah.
And
so it was voluntary? You didn't do the movie? You didn't work?
No. It was a combination of every time I would get a movie together, the financing would fall apart.
Uh-huh.
The world changed for... It was the strike came. So
yeah.
I used to make a lot of money writing scripts for other people.
Uh-huh.
Like I wrote a movie for Julia Roberts and I wrote for Bob Zemeckis and that went away. And the kind of movies that I made, dramedies, there was no market for them for a while. Whereas they're still hard, but at least now, you know, you make a movie for $7 to $10 million with a movie star and it's, you know that Netflix or Amazon or HBO or Showtime or someone is going to buy that thing, you're never going to lose money.
It's like a buffer.
But there was 4 or 5 years where that buffer wasn't there. The DVD went away.
Right.
Right? The DVD, you know, when I did Upside of Anger, that movie might have made $25 million at the box office, but it probably made $70 million in DVD.
Right.
Because every guy or woman, you know, Joan Allen, Kevin Costner. Yeah, I saw that movie. I could buy it for $19 and watch it forever or have it in my living room.
Right.
And it was at every store and everything. And it sold like crazy.
Yeah.
But that went away.
Right.
So until the Netflix and the Amazon and the iTunes came picked up again, there was no second market for my kind of movies. So
did you get depressed?
Oh yeah, I'd get depressed. It was a very dark period in my life, but you know, without, you know,
booze. Yeah.
No, but without, you know, I mean, I was lucky because I'm sober and I really have a very strong faith in God, very strong faith. And it, you know, I thought this is a time in my life and I was 50 years old.
Yeah.
I thought this is either going to kill me or I'm going to start having an affair. Or I'm going to start drinking again, or I'm going to gain 40 pounds, or I'm going to go somewhere and run away.
Yeah.
Or I'm going to just stay here and figure it out and keep writing every day and kind of turn inward and really find out who I am. Not to say it was just some brave, you know, I wasn't, you know, but you really find out who you are during tough times. And I remember a couple of the young guys or younger guys that I work with in AA, they'd say, man, I don't know what I would have done if I went broke. Because I lost, I built a mansion, I lost it. I mean, I lost so much property-wise, physical-wise.
Yeah.
But I gained so much because I really learned that I was okay with nothing. As long as I was writing and as long as I was a really good guy. And
Kept your family together.
Kept my family together, you know, I picked up a lot of AA commitments.
Yeah.
I had a meeting that I ran and I was the doorman or the greeter or the chip guy. So I had to be at a meeting every day. And I really kind of, I'd spent a life where my career and how successful I was the most important thing. And I was forced to for 5 years, just how good a guy I was each day, that became the most important thing.
Wow.
And I had a sense that it was going to swing back for me. I really did. I really had a sense that it would swing back and I'd have an even more successful period in my life if I didn't melt down during this period.
Fuck it all up.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was really hard. 5 years is a long time.
Yeah.
Especially when from the time I was 18 on, I always did something. I always had a show, a movie, a this or that going every year.
Yeah.
You know, I wasn't as successful as Woody Allen, but I had the same life as him. I was constantly casting, shooting, editing, going. Uh-huh. And then it just went away, you know? But I look at it now as a really, it was as what I needed more than anything, because I think the work, not that the work is deeper, because I think that's a cliche, but the work is clearer.
Right.
You know, if I'm writing a thriller, I know exactly what I'm writing, and I kind of, a lot of the reviews and the stuff that I could take some constructive criticism was that some of my movies didn't know what they wanted to be, you know?
And now you're clear on that. And I bet you're clear on who your friends are, too.
That's so true. That's really true. I mean, you know, my best friends are, one's a dentist and one's a home builder, you know? I mean, you really realize that the guys in the business, they can't help but be affected by the price of your stock. And you don't want them to be, but they are, you know?
Yeah, and the funny thing is like I said at the beginning, you know, I thought you were fucking hilarious.
Oh, thanks.
And it was like, you know, like I can still remember, you had such a, as a stand-up, you had such a confidence and such a, like, there was something, you know, completely fresh and like, you know, it was just...
Yeah, that's what I had. I had a poise that my talent didn't quite get to know, you know? I mean, I was comfortable on stage.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to be on there so bad as a young guy, and especially when I was sober, I really had looked like a 50-year-old in a 18-year-old's body doing a real polished act, but it wasn't fresh. There was no unique point of view to it.
Right, right.
It was just me doing jokes, yeah. You know. And as soon as I realized that, I said, okay, it's time to hang this up.
But just in terms of my personal life, I think that you were one of the guys I saw, and I'm like, you know, people do this. You can do this.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
And I appreciate that.
Well, I remember when I started, and my dad would say, you really going to be a comedian?
Yeah.
And I'd say, look, Dad, let me just show you something. And I showed him, like, Billy Braver on The Tonight Show.
Do you know Billy Braver? I had him in here.
Oh, yeah, okay. I mean, I said...
with his lunchbox?
I said, this guy, you've never heard of him, but he's making a living.
Yeah.
And then I showed him Tom Dreesen. I said, this guy goes out... There are hundreds and hundreds of guys around this country that are doing great as comedians. It's you think, because you don't know of them, that I'm going into this horrible business. But you're wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Did he finally believe you?
He did, yeah. Yeah, my dad came to love comedians. He opened up a comedy club in Fort Myers, Florida.
He did?
Yeah, called the Bijou Comedy Club. And he really, when he was retired, you know, he financed it, put it this way.
Uh-huh.
You know, and all the guys, Seinfeld and Tim Allen, and so many guys came and played. He was a great guy.
Out of respect for you?
No,
just
it was a good gig.
Yeah,
it was a good gig. Yeah. It was in Fort Myers, Florida, and my dad would take them boating. My dad had a fishing boat, and he would call me up and go, "Mike, I'm here with Tim Allen. Mike, I'm here with Jerry Seinfeld." You know, and they liked him,
uh-huh.
And he loved he you know, his through his friendship with Leno, and through me, he really learned to love comedians. And,
huh.
You know, my dad, he died young. He had an accident, you know, and he at 72, he had a bad fall, and it was dead 8 days later, you know. But he was a great guy, and he really, through me, learned to understand, you know, even long after I was out of comedy.
Yeah.
He was friends with comedians, and he loved comedians, and he really understood not only what a tough life it is, but what a unique skill set it is,
uh-huh.
You know, and he would call me up and say, you've got to see this kid, you know, Bill Hicks. I said, yeah, I know Bill Hicks, Dad. You know what I mean? you know.
Did he ever bother you to get back in it?
No. He knew. He knew that I was making movies, and he liked that too. He liked to come on the sets, and you know, he liked to pal around with Kevin Costner I had this movie with Donald Sutherland was in one of my movies, and that made my dad happy, you know.
Oh, that's sweet, man. That's sweet. And you work with your brother.
Yeah. Yeah, my brother, not anymore. We're doing our own things now. My brother's actually producing the biography of Dionne Warwick's life.
Wow. But you got a good relationship with him.
Yeah, great relationship. It just, you know, you can only work with for your big brother so many years. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm a big brother. I don't know. It's not easy being a little brother.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah, and at a certain point.
Yeah.
Plus, it was very conveniently timed to the time when I stopped getting work. He was like, hey, man, what's your next movie? Because if not, I'm on my own. You know, and he's gone on. He's done very well, actually.
And so have you, man. I really appreciate you talking to me, buddy.
I'm really glad I came.
It was great. Thanks, yeah. Mike.
That was pretty cool. That was it. That was me and Mike Binder. It was very exciting to talk to Mike. Got a lot of respect for that guy for a lot of reasons. Go to WTFpod.com for all your WTF Pod needs. Check out the merch. Check out the posters. Check out, you know, you can get on the mailing list. You can comment there through Facebook so I know who you are. So you're not just a maggot among maggots. Yeah, don't want to be one of those people. Cyber maggots. Internet's full of them.
Folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.